start with SJR 7. Then we will do Senate Bill 758 and then close out with SJR 30. We have, committee, a very busy week this week, so I appreciate the two that are here and the three that are not. We anxiously await your arrival. Open a public hearing on SJR 7. Mr. Yates.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Richard Yates with the Legislative Revenue Office. SJR 7 proposes an amendment to the Oregon Constitution to reduce the general fund match required to issue general obligation bonds under Article 11G. 11G is open both to higher education bonds and also to community college bonds. And currently requires a dollar-for-dollar match, and this would reduce it to essentially three times the amount the bonds could be issued equal to three times the amount of general fund money available. As the bill is drafted, it refers it to the voters at the primary election on May 18, 2004, and I see we have an amendment that would change that to the general election.
The general of 2004 is what the dash ones do?
Yes. So it would be November 2004. I'm not sure what
doing that's
what day in November.
Yeah, right. Thank you. President Frohmeyer, Chancellor Jarvis, and I don't know, President White is, he might be very busy today. He's on the list. Afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, Richard Jarvis, Chancellor of the Oregon University System, and thank you for the opportunity to testify before you on behalf of SJR 7. As noted, the amendment would change the present match requirement of $1 in general fund for each $1 in bonds to a new match requirement of $1 in general fund to $3 in bonds. We're requesting this change because since the passage of ballot measure 5 in 1990, the OUS has received only $9,600,000 in general fund match for the construction of only six projects. All of the rest of the projects approved by the legislature, some 14 in number, were advanced only because the campus leadership was able to secure other funds. The other funds are primarily gifts, federal funds, and other non-general fund and non-tuition campus incomes. This transfer of match development from the state to the OUS campuses has resulted in continued delay of needed educational buildings, library, labs, classrooms, computer and technology centers, and student support services for our rapidly growing student enrollments. If the amendment is approved, only the match requirement would change. All other statutory regulations and safeguards remain in place, namely, development of campus master plans, State Board of Higher Education review and approval of plans and priorities, approval and submission of the capital construction budget by the governor, legislative review, amendment approval of the capital construction budget, legislative approval of the bond budget bill, allowing the sale of the bonds authorized. Campuses would still have to secure the match for the bonds authorized if the legislature appropriates no general fund for this purpose, and debt service on the bonds sold is still charged against the general fund appropriated for the OUS operating budget each biennium. No change in any of those elements. The result will be a more manageable campus match threshold, timely construction of needed educational facilities, and better service to the growing demand by Oregonians for quality higher education. The OUS has one amendment. We want to move the election on SJR 7 to the November 2004 general election. The change can safely delay the adoption of the constitutional amendment as the effect of the match formula is prospective in nature, affecting future projects in the next round of budgets considered by the 2005 legislature. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
So, Chancellor, why the November 4, not the next primary election, is there, other than...
Mr. Chairman, I believe the sense was that we would be proceeding as anticipated during the next biennium and would see this moving under the current process for that period of time.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Dave Frohnmeyer, president of the University of Oregon. I thank you for the opportunity to appear and testify on behalf of Senate Joint Resolution Number 7. I agree entirely with the points that the Chancellor has made. I only wish to add a couple of points of emphasis. First, as you know, we are engaged in dealing with record enrollments at virtually every institution of higher education, and these are projected to continue until the year at least 2009. Our facilities have not kept pace with the growth of enrollment. There's a desperate need to build new facilities. We many times have willing donors to help us on the private side, knowing that the state side funding may not be available. But nonetheless, the rigidity of the one-to-one match ratio has been an inhibition, especially for academic units that don't necessarily have the strength of the donor base that, say, a school of business or a school of law would have. We are currently confronting that at the University of Oregon, where we have much-needed improvements scheduled for our School of Music, much-needed improvements for the College of Education, now ranked as the nation's second most significant such college. And having this flexibility would be a major advantage to us and to our colleagues in the state system. I would point out that even predating our chancellor's selection and arrival at in the state of Oregon, we campuses and the chancellor's predecessor got together last year and tried to look systematically at every single inhibition to flexibility that we might be facing and as to which legislative action or action by the people might allow us to have greater flexibility to cope with the difficult times fiscally that we knew we were going to be facing and that you would be facing. And this is part of that set of flexibility initiatives to give campuses the capacity to deal more effectively with times of fiscal downturn as we are in now and for the immediate future. So we very much need this measure. We hope that you will enact it. I would add, Senator Deckard, in response to your question, that one additional reason perhaps to postpone the election until the November election is that a major bonding issue to deal with deferred maintenance on all of the campuses, which may have as much as a $500 million price tag, will be on the ballot in the primary election. And I think our thinking is that rather than overcrowd the ballot with fiscal measures of that kind facing higher education, it might be better to stagger them so that the public can swallow them in relatively bite-sized morsels. So that's some of the reason behind the timing issue that you're asked to consider today. Thank you.
Thank you. President.
Well, fair day question. Nice, yes. Mm-hmm. Checking out the colors. Senator Ringo, thank you.
Bill Beaver.
Beavers.
Oh, are we going to start that again?
Well, I sit here, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Tim White, president of Oregon State University, and to just lend my support to this joint resolution, Senate Joint Resolution 7. As Chancellor Jarvis and President Frommeyer have said, it's the right thing for our university system, it seems to us. And we've been successful on occasion raising private funds with a one-to-one match. The most outstanding example in the current era is our Kelly Engineering Center, which has a $20 million in bonds, but a $25 million in private money, you know, which 20 came from the Kellys, and that's a very great gift for us, but it's also one that comes from lots of time in between those sorts of gifts. SJR 7 would, as you know, allow us to then go to a 3-to-1 match. I see five bullets here. One is it would leverage more private investments, it seems to me, in capital facilities on university campuses, because donors would know that for every private dollar they give, there would be three in financing. It would also encourage more donors, unlike the means of the Kellys, who can give $20 million when they believe in a dream. It would allow others to invest at a lower amount and still have the same level of impact. It'll give us an advantage in competing with our other states, and as you know, that we are really in a world competitive environment, and we simply have to have the facilities to attract the faculty and the staff and the students to do world-class research, and then the leverage that comes from those extramural research dollars. It's not going to send us as a state into debt. As you know, the legislature has the final authority on making those decisions on a legislative-to-legislative basis. So it seems to us that it will allow us to create the facilities for instructional programs and for research that really are in the best interest of the economic recovery of the state and its long-term well-being. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Questions? President White, you kind of touched on this. It's the first bullet point on yours. How do you answer that perhaps this might lessen the climate at the foundation in terms of going out and getting private dollars, that by doing this in some ways we might put the wrong incentive out there to really press hard for private dollars on construction projects?
Chairman Deckard, I mean, that's a reasonable question and a good question. And I suspect we need to test the hypothesis. But I think, I mean, as I've thought deeply about that question, the one point that I keep coming back to is that the number of priorities and initiatives that all the university campuses are seeking to invest in far outstrips the ability of both private giving and public funding to support. And so when you look at the balance between what the needs are to maintain that competitive edge and to gain it in some areas, I don't see this sort of leading to an evolution where we would become lazy or unaggressive with our foundations. As you are well aware, the foundation giving across the country is down a little bit with this economy, but we're in the third year of a three-year slide, hopefully. And so the giving will be coming back. There's lots of wealth in this country to transfer still. And I think this will create more opportunities for investment rather than less, and that will become appealing to the wide range of people who believe deeply in our programs.
Mr. Chairman, may I supplement that remark with my own observations and maybe showing longevity in this process, but perhaps only Senator Hannan and I in this room are have been around the building long enough to remember when the state used to general fund all capital construction projects and when even the notion of bonding was somewhat foreign. And, in fact, there was a lawsuit against the legislature for funding the wings on this building with a sort of a semi-cockamamie bonding scheme instead of directly general funding. Well, those times are long since passed. And as a matter of fact, my experience with donors has been their concern that the state does not stand behind its public universities sufficiently to justify their philanthropy. So, in fact, I think this would be an incentive to donors to say, I've done my part, and now the public is stepping up for public universities for public purposes. And I've heard that concern enough that I actually think that the passage of this measure would be an incentive to private philanthropy rather than a detriment to it.
This isn't a U of O, or this is more of an OSU, but I think of the Kelly investment.
Mm-hmm.
Would it perhaps, and this is conjecture, and I'm supportive of SJR7, would have that perhaps been a lower contribution or donation under the SJR7 laws? I know it's just somewhat of a guess, but I guess if that's the only question that just kind of muddles around, or we heard this in education before, that kind of just muddles mm-hmm. around in my mind on an otherwise very good idea,
right.
But we'll move forward.
I have to be a little bit careful in answering that because I don't want to violate some trust that we have in our conversations with our donors. But I guess I would assure you that if there was a different kind of match in this case of the Kelly Engineering Building, that there might have been broader investments by that group. Right. I don't think it would have diminished the amount of the resource. It simply would have had a greater impact by a factor of three.
Mm-hmm.
And when you look at programs mm-hmm. like engineering technology, or you look at the programs that President Frommeyer is investing in on his campus, or President Bernstein at Portland State. I mean, there are people who have the means to invest in things they believe deeply about. And so I guess I'm encouraged that we will be ahead of the game, not behind the game. And I guess it's up to the president and the foundations and the deans to be certain that we don't get lazy in our private efforts on private giving. And I quite frankly don't think that would be the case.
Senator Hannan.
Yes. Yes, Mr. Chairman. I want to welcome the Chancellor and both Presidents here. President Frommeyer and I go back a few years. I won't try to date us. But
just leave it at old.
just at old? Okay. But we did go back to a time when General Fund paid major constructions in Oregon. And we've got away from that. And this is a way we can tie commitment in on behalf of the state, but yet exercise contributions from individuals through foundations and grants and everything. And that's why Senator Clarno asked me if I would sign on this with her and support it. And I can only say that I strongly support this measure being referred to the voters. And I would urge that we try to exercise the use of tax credits, tax contribution, charitable giving that is in place to maximize these funds, because we really have a future in our university system in Oregon, and I don't want to see it dismantled brick by brick. I want to see it built brick by brick and see it grow and prosper. And so I know with the leadership we have here, President Frommer's commitment to University of Oregon and President White's commitment to OSU and the Chancellor's commitment, that we're going to see that objective reached. And the other presidents join in you. I know that President Bernstein of Portland State has also shared with me that his commitment is there to see us grow. And together we can make this a world-class institution, as the advertisements say. We are indeed a world-class institution, and we can build upon that. And I want to thank all three of you for being here. Even though I didn't wear an OSU tie today, it clashed with my shirt. And
your shirt clashes with your jacket.
Well, now that you've been critiquing me here, I appreciate your comments.
I'm right out of gentleman.
Senator Hannon, he walked in and critiqued my attire today.
So has he? He's been in critiquing mode today.
I would have been on everybody's advise other members of the committee to be coming.
But I do appreciate your leadership that all of you bring to our education, and we want to stand with you and support it.
Thank you so much.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Ringa.
Well, just a comment. I just think this is a easy first step. And I just really think we need to do a lot more to support them. And there's a lot of focus right now on economic development. And from my perspective, I think supporting our education system, including higher ed, is really the best economic development we could have in our state. So this is easy.
Just on that point, I perhaps should resist this, but we've actually had a microeconomic study done of our expenditures, Senator. Uh-huh. And by good analysis, not by superficial, we've determined that for every dollar that's spent by the University of Oregon, it redounds to a $10 benefit to the Oregon economy. Wow. That's pretty good leverage. And I know the same is true of Oregon State University. But this the subject of an economic study of considerable sophistication. So your observation, in my view, is absolutely correct.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Ringa.
Changing the subject then away from SCR-7, but have you done analysis to compare how that multiplier effect contrasts with the other projects currently contemplated by OECDD?
Actually, Senator, we have not, had not been requested to do so, but I would be pleased to provide you with the short form of the economic analysis, and you can make your own justification. The University of Oregon is the 18th largest economic entity in the state of Oregon. We directly support 4,000 small businesses throughout the state of Oregon. 89% of our expenditures or so are within the physical boundaries of the state of Oregon, but most of our revenue comes from outside the state of Oregon. So it is a huge balance of payments plus, and the same is true of my colleague in Corrales.
I would be interested in seeing that.
We'll provide that for you.
Thank you.
Yeah, I've seen the study. I hope that y'all make that to the available Ways and Means if you do a presentation tomorrow. I think it's a very powerful study in terms of the leveraging that can take place.
Yes. Thank you, sir.
On that point, if I might, Chair Deckard, there's one way to analyze the question, as President Frommer just did, which is an economic approach. Another simple way to do it is if you consider world-class facility, world-class program allows you to attract world-class faculty. When they come, they require several things. One is, of course, a commitment to their salary, but there's what we call startup charges, startup costs, and they range in the sciences anywhere from a couple hundred thousand dollars to upwards to $1 million, depending on the level of the investigator. So we took a look, and again, this could be said for any university in the system. It's not unique to Oregon State. We looked at what return on the investment for those startup packages occurred over the last 5 years. And for every dollar we spent on startup money, we got $4.3 back. And since we invested annually about $1 million, That's a return to the Oregon economy of 4.3. Before you take those dollars and do the multiplication factors that President Forman was alluding to. If you look at a new investigator and take it out for a 24-month window, that return is about 7.5. And so the investment of research money into startup packages returns 7.5. And over the course of 6 years, if my memory is correct, we have about $34 million of federal money basically coming back to Oregon with about a $6 million investment. Mm-hmm. And so it speaks to the point that Senator Ringo is raising, is this is makes good economic sense as well as good intellectual sense for our campuses.
Senator Hannon.
Mr. Chairman, I was just going to say, I apologize to President Frommer. He and I go back to about 1958. Jeez. In the summer. We used to play in the city band in Ashland, and we both played trumpet. And President Frommer would come home in the summers and from school, and I was just a little snot-nosed kid playing the trumpet, and he was older than I was, and of course I looked up to his guidance and direction then as well as now. So President Frommer, it's good to see you as always.
Thank you very much, Senator Hannon.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks. Trumpet, I would have figured you for a fiddler. Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Corker.
Oh, he's not here. I wanted to commend Senator Starr. If you'll notice, he's removed that ghastly tie and put on a real tie, as opposed to Senator Ringo, who hasn't gotten a clue yet.
I might wear this. White might have to come
back.
Do
we go to work session?
We're going to. Melissa, you don't need no one else. Closed public hearing, open work session on SJR 7, Senator Farioli.
I move SJR to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and further that Senator Ringo will remove that police tape that he's wearing.
Don't you have to do an amendment?
Dash one. Yeah, we need
to. Oh, beg your pardon, Mr. Chairman. Move the dash one amendments to SJR 7.
Senator Farioli has moved the dash one amendments to SJR 7. Any discussion? Any objection? It's ordered. Senator Farioli.
Mr. Chairman, would like to move the bill as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Senator Farioli has moved SJR 7 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any objection? Any discussion? Any objection? Would you like to carry some hand?
Yes, Senator Carno and myself would probably jointly carry it if that's permissible.
Perfect.
You're more care about education. You should have a Democrat.
Senator Clarno and Senator Hannon will carry SJR 7 to the floor for our committee.
No, I take that back. You should carry all the bonding bills.
Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 7058. Thank you, Mr. Yates.
Well,
I was just 7 years old when you were playing with it.
Well, the chairman was still in preschool.
I think not born yet.
The chairman wasn't even a boss. Lizbeth.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, what you have before you is Senate Bill 758. Is it authorizes a personal income tax credit for an individual that provides unreimbursed care to a relative that consists of providing assistance to a relative with daily living activities for more than 6 months. It requires the relative receiving care to not reside in a nursing home, assisted living facility, or other resident with activities of daily living is provided. It specifies that the relative must receive physical, mental or developmental disability assistance for daily living from the taxpayer. It limits that income tax credit to $1,500 per year with a 5-year carry forward. It limits the federal adjusted gross income of the eligible taxpayer receiving the credit to $60,000. It allows a husband and wife who file separate returns to share in the income tax credit in proportion to the assistance contribution of each individual, and applies to tax years beginning on or after January 1st, 2003. So basically, under current law, we do not have this specific income tax credit. We do have a few others, and I just listed them there. Costs in lieu of nursing home care and a child and developmental care credit in Oregon.
Ms. Raymond, Ms. Cribb, Mr. Harvey, and Mr. Davis, you're on deck. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Chairman Deckert and members of the committee, my name is Dolores Raymond. I live in Aloha, but I'm originally from Burns, and I still miss the smell of sagebrush. I grew up in Harney County many long years ago, and I was part of a large ranch family that we very much took care of our own, and it made a tremendous impression on me. When my grandmother had a stroke, my Aunt Esther left her career as a registered nurse in Los Angeles and came home to the ranch to be a family caregiver and take care of her. So I knew about family caregivers at a very early age. First of all, I want to thank you for hearing Senate Bill 758. And second, we have not very many people here to testify today. We hadn't much notice, but I ask you to look at each of us and see us as representing thousands of family caregivers who can't be here today because they have no respite, no relief caregiver to step in and give them a break. So we're here on their behalf. Those family caregivers are in one of every four households in the country for someone who requires special care. Also, I've taken the liberty of providing you with copies of testimony from family caregivers from past sessions when this bill was heard, because they couldn't be here. I've spoken with many family caregivers and sometimes been able to help them find a relief caregiver. Sometimes I've been able to direct them to some funds that will help them pay for respite. But I want to tell you specifically about a young couple with three sons whose story broke my heart. The oldest is 10, has attention deficit disorder. The youngest are 7 and 5. They are autistic. They're nonverbal. They're hyperactive. They're up and active and noisy at night because they sleep very little, and that means that the entire family gets very little sleep. These boys have no concept of danger or of the consequences of their behavior. The youngest fell out of a second-story window when he tried to retrieve his teddy bear that he dropped. And since then, they've put special locks on all the doors and windows. The 7-year-old walks on the kitchen counters instead of on the floor. And while his mother was distracted one day with another child, he knocked over a kettle of hot soup and burned himself. The father helps as much as he can, but he works long hours, and his insurance benefits aren't adequate for the overwhelming health care needs of his family. There's a sister-in-law who helps when she can, and once in a while they get a small amount of help through lifespan respite. But none of this is enough. And passing the lifespan respite bill in the 97th session is one of the outstanding good things that this legislature has done. It's a great program. The only time this mother has for herself is 4 hours, 5 days a week, when the boys are in school. The youngest goes to early intervention. She has to choose between whether to try to get some sleep or to come somewhere near keeping up with the housework and the cooking, the laundry, and all the things that a family requires. Her health is deteriorating. She does not feel well. She recently had major surgery. She's exhausted. And I can't help but wonder whether she may turn out to be one of the family caregivers who dies from the effects of long-term stress. These young parents are determined to keep their family together. This mother told me that her family, her boys, were the most important thing in her life. And if she's exhausted, she's prepared to cope with that. This family falls into the middle-income families that are not eligible for public benefits, and they can't afford the out-of-pocket costs of care. They fit in the parameters of the middle-income families that are designated by Senate Bill 758. This bill very nearly passed in the 2001 session. You may remember it. It got to the final hours of the session and met an ignominious end by being gotten stuffed, and I was devastated, as were many of us. When this session came around, we looked at whether we should come back with this bill, and there was a lot of uncertainty and a lot of discussion. We know that this state is in dire financial straits, and you guys are facing just a gargantuan task. Nevertheless, we did decide to come back with the bill, and looking at it, we decided that the value of family caregivers deserves recognition in the form of a tax credit. There's an increasing shortage of caregivers as the aging of boomers increases the need. The fact that the state is in such financial trouble and long-term care facilities are affected means that family caregivers are going to be more important than ever. I spoke with another family recently where the wife quit work in order to stay at home and take care of her grandmother. So that affects their income, their household. They'll be paying less in income taxes. But again, here's a family who's important and willing to take care of their own. If we look at this bill, based on an estimated 7,500 qualified taxpayers per year who would take an average credit of $860, the annual cost would be $6.4 million. That sounds like a lot when we look at the shortfall. But actually, it's a drop in the bucket if you compare it to the cost of a long-term care facility that can be upwards of $50,000 annually per person. I know we realize that this state is in desperate need of long-term solutions. We haven't had any good long-term solutions for a while. This bill is an important piece of those solutions. It will support families, and it will help to reduce the overall cost of long-term care in the long run. I want to thank you, gentlemen, for your attention and for your careful consideration of this bill. I know how hard you're working and how difficult this challenging session is. I ask you to vote yes on Senate Bill 758 and pass it out of committee with a due pass recommendation, and then I will pray for a miracle. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Duffett, members of the committee, my name is Nicola Cribb. I am a volunteer with the Oregon chapter of the National Multiple Sclerosis Society.
Thank you.
Sorry, you hear me now? This bill, as Dolores mentioned, has been around for a good few sessions. It's had more success than others, and we're hoping it would have success this time. It matters a lot to the MS Society. In some ways, it's a fairly minor bill. But it has a huge impact on anybody with MS and who needs care, and a huge host of other folks who are coping with some form of illness, whether it be the family that Dolores mentioned, the Alzheimer's Association. This impacts a huge number of people. And Dolores has championed this for a good many years, and we did struggle this time whether we should bring it forward again. We do understand what you're going through as a legislature with the issues before you are just tremendous. The reason we did bring it back forward this time is because I think this time more than ever, it really matters to these folks who maybe don't have the option anymore of looking to the state for full-time care for their family members. Those options are diminishing just with the financial situation we're in as a state. The state can no longer step in as readily as it has been able to in past years. So families are having to step up to the plate more than ever before. And this bill, it not only recognizes those caregivers who are looking after their own, but it also gives them potentially a few days of respite care that they wouldn't otherwise be able to afford. And those few days, and it might not seem like that much to those of us who aren't coping with a family member who needs full-time care, but just 3 or 4 days off to rejuvenate for both the patient and the caregiver can make all the difference in the world. And without that, families can give up. And Dolores wasn't exaggerating when she said that there are caregivers who do ultimately die from not being able to cope with their family. It's a long term thing, but the stresses are immense, and that can have a huge impact on the caregiver's health, not just the patient. So it's a difficult time, we know that, but this is a very important bill. It's a relatively minor fiscal impact, but it will make a huge difference to some people who need the help. Thanks.
Thank you. My name is Robert Harvey. I speak from the standpoint of one who has cared for a spouse with Alzheimer's disease. My wife was diagnosed in 1997 after several years of dementia-like symptoms, which were diagnosed as aphasia, but which probably were in reality early onset Alzheimer's. When it became obvious that it was not prudent for her to remain at home alone, several friends in our church volunteered to come and stay with her several times a week while I was able to do such things as continue my workouts in a fitness center, believing that her best interest would be served by my keeping my health intact. I also spent one afternoon a week playing bridge. When you play bridge, you cannot think of anything else if you're going to play bridge successfully at all. And then shopping came in around the edges of those times. As the caregiving became more strenuous, as I knew it would, such things as changing all the bedclothes in the middle of the night, sometimes twice in one night, the personality changes, which are extremely difficult for a spouse, having lived with a loving wife for many years, and to find her hitting you and screaming at you, and the emotion that goes along with that on both parts, as well as our children. I kept my wife at home as long as possible. It became obvious after several years that it was no longer safe to keep her at home, and I needed to find secure care for her. The change from the home environment to an institutional environment, no matter how safe and caring it was going to be wrenching, and it certainly was. I am convinced that without the friends who helped me out so generously, I would have had to have my wife institutionalized 6 months earlier than I did. There's no question in my mind but what that was case. Now, the point of my testimony is, since I got a lot of help with my caregiving, there are scores and scores of other people in our area, that is the Mid-Willamette Valley area, who are going through the trauma of caring for a person with Alzheimer's who do not have the support that I had. I was 69 when I was diagnosed, or when my wife was diagnosed with Alzheimer's. Many, many people who get that Alzheimer's diagnosis are in their 80s, and a spouse in his or her 80s is not capable of doing hard work that it takes to be the kind of caregiver that is required. Some people who are diagnosed with Alzheimer's are alone. Some are being cared for by grown children, many of whom work full-time. And sometimes it ends up being a child comes in after school. I recall the case of a granddaughter who came to one of our Alzheimer's support group meetings, who was caring. She was a grown woman, but she was caring for her grandmother who had Alzheimer's, and it was very obvious that she did not like caring for her grandmother, and that her grandmother was as cranky as could be, and yet she was stuck. She had no place to go, no place to turn. She just did the best she could. Often the only solution is early placement in a care facility. Now, that means for many of these people, Medicaid, and of course the state begins to pay. But as you well know, for every dollar that the state pays, the federal government returns $3. If some significant help were available, the level of care would be better for these people who are caught in these situations, and the state expense, the dollar paid out, multiplied by quite a few, of course, would be less. This proposed tax credit for paid home care is one such solution, it seems to me. Of the persons who are in this room as I speak, those who live to be 85, 50% of them will have Alzheimer's disease. Now, maybe the people in this room will be able to cope with that, but there are an awful lot of people out there who can't. It's a cruel disease. It's one of our most significant social problems, and it deserves your help. I thank you for listening.
Thank you, sir.
Questions or... Senator Ringo.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple questions. One is I wanted to, first of all, I think it's a good bill. My name's on it. I think it's great to give this type of assistance. And I would also note that it is means tested, so that with a $60,000 of income figure, so that it's targeted towards more modest income levels. But I was wondering, Dolores, you mentioned an $800 figure. And what did that refer to?
That came from a fiscal impact statement from a previous session.
I see. Mr. Chair, do we have a... I mean, I'm looking at this report, but is there a more detailed revenue...
Not yet, Senator Ringo.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, thank you.
We're holding
I'd
on.
Be happy to send you a copy of that statement from... from another session, if that would be of help.
Yeah, we have.
Well, no, thank you, because I'm sure that they can generate it pretty easily. Okay, but thank you very much.
What was the fiscal last session? Do you know offhand? Our ballpark
on this. The figure that sticks in my mind is that $6.4 million.
$6.4 million.
That's a one-year figure.
Thank you. Mr. Davis, you want to come on up, and I'm hesitant to say back cleanup, but I'll do it. Back cleanup.
On deck, back cleanup. Get us in the mood. Got our baseball hats today.
I've got mine. I've got my hats, but they're for my kids.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Jim Davis. I'm a gerontologist and psychologist from Portland area, from Senator Deckard's district, as a matter of fact, and I represent the Alzheimer's Association of Oregon, Greater Idaho, United Seniors of Oregon, Great Panthers, Save Oregon Seniors, and the Advocacy Coalition of Seniors and People with Disabilities. We have come here to express our strong support for Senate Bill 758. Most of our organizations have been supporting it for years in an attempt to get some kind of a credit on personal income tax for Oregon taxpayers who are providing care to a relative or loved one who faces physical, mental, or developmental disability. This is an important piece of legislation to us, and it's geared to providing assistance for full-time caregivers who are giving care and assistance of activities of daily living to loved ones with a severe disability. And it's very, very critical in terms of the care of our senior and disability population, many of whom are suffering very serious physical disabilities as well as dementia, which is a great concern of ours. The need for this type of support is escalating as care providers over the past decade have nearly tripled. These care providers are sacrificing their normal lives for the care of these loved ones. They're foregoing professional obligations and social obligations. They're suffering a unique kind of emotional and physical stress in terms of providing this kind of care that will cause them both physical and emotional problems. And what's interesting is that caregiver depression is now considered one of the most significant episodes of senior mental health crisis and problems. Caregivers make tremendous financial sacrifices, as you have heard in testimony before. Unless there's government assistance that's available, they're really reimbursing a lot of the care And for income families who have incomes under $60,000 in the lower and middle income brackets, this is a tremendous sacrifice. But literally tens of millions of dollars are being spent each year out of families' pockets to provide for their loved ones. But the financial impact is really being felt outside the home. A lot of these individuals are working, have to take time off from work, and nationwide, for the care of Alzheimer's disease alone, it is estimated that it costs businesses over $60 billion a year nationwide for their employed caregivers who are caring for 19 million plus Americans who have families with this disease. And the numbers are going to increase exponentially when you look at the boomer population that's coming up. If you've ever looked at that data, you will understand, if you're still a legislator, the long-term crisis that you're going to be facing in the very near future. This measure is also a good investment for the state. If seniors and people with disabilities are being cared for in their own homes by family members who are getting some support, then they're not in long-term care facilities, and most of whom would then be on state assistance and need Medicaid. They will ultimately spend down, as most do, in those situations. And so in the long run, the state is ultimately going to have to pay the bill one way or the other. This just gives the opportunity for a loved one to stay in a home setting for a lot longer. So we feel it is long overdue that the state of Oregon provide more financial support to the tireless and dedicated home care providers, family home care providers, who are sacrificing their life in return for making the lives of their loved ones with serious disability more comfortable and enjoyable. Please support Senate Bill 758.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
758, anyone else? If not, I'm alerting Senator Walker that SJR 30 is coming up. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 758 and open a public hearing on SJR 30. Thank you, Elizabeth. Mr. Yates, this is pretty straightforward.
Mr. Chair, Richard Yates, Legislative Revenue, Senate Joint Resolution 30, is a proposed constitutional amendment which would say if you have a telephone tax or a tax on telephone service, telephone subscriber lines, or cellular, wireless, or radio common carrier instruments, the revenue must be used to fund emergency and public safety communications facilities, equipment, and services. And this would go to the people on the November 2004 general election.
Thank you.
Yeah. Question.
Senator Starr.
Thank you. Does this impact the fee that's on telephone lines that fund the programs for the deaf? Isn't there a program that helps the deaf and their TPY lines and those? Does this impact that?
I would think not. I would want to check that out. But that is an assessment, essentially, that's done on the phone companies, and then the money is used to provide that service.
But isn't
not directly on lines or on...
I think it's a per phone line fee, though, is it not?
I don't believe so. I'll check that out. I think it's a gross revenue assessment.
Underhand.
I believe it goes for several things. It was supposed to go for low income assistance at one time, and it was supposed to, and an add on went for emergency telephone, and then an add-on to that went for 911 assistance, and so they've kind of layered it, haven't they, Mr. Yates?
Go ahead, please.
The 911 access fee is a separate fee.
Is it a separate fee?
Yes, it's 75 cents per subscriber who has access to 911 emergency communications. And that revenue, that clearly is, I think, what the bill addresses. The other charges are separate. They're not part of that charge so far.
So they wouldn't be included. They wouldn't be included in this?
Well, I would not.
It says all monies.
Yeah.
It's pretty broad.
I think you're right. I think that we need to clarify it.
It says to require revenue from any state telephone tax. It doesn't say for this or for that. It just says any state telephone tax. My question I had was, are we going to take money away from other specific programs that we tax and put in here on all 911 now?
I know we would take the 622 money from Senate Bill 622 that we're building infrastructure.
This would loop it in.
I think so. I mean, in working on that bill a couple sessions ago, Senator Walker, you're up. This would, by the language in this, I think it would take those funds. So we probably, if this bill moved forward, would need to be tightened.
Yes, it does.
Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Vicki Walker, State Senator, District 7. We're in work session over in business and labor, so it took me just a moment. Yes, this bill does need to be tightened in that Commissioner Lee Beyer with the PUC told me that the bill is a little bit broad in terms of capturing all telephone excise taxes. So my intent with this bill is really simple. It is a very simple little bill, members of the committee and Mr. Chair. And everybody wants their hands on the 911 money. It's a little bit frustrating because it was set up to take care of 911 emergency services. And as you know, during special session, we grabbed a lot of it. I think $14 million, if I recall correctly.
Ended up nine, I believe.
Ended up nine.
High
and low, high and low. But my point is that those monies are, we have a tax on our phone bill of 75 cents, and it pays for that. And to use it for any other purpose, I think, is inappropriate, because if there's too much money in the fund, then let's lower the tax. And the fund was set up for this specific purpose. Actually, in 1995, the legislature converted the telephone tax from 5% of the access charge to a flat amount of 75 cents per month. And I just really think that it's inappropriate for the legislature to keep playing with this fund. The money was to go to enhance 911 services, which, if you are aware of those things, that would be your cell phone. You're on your cell phone and you call 911, as a gentleman tried to do in Eugene when he'd been stabbed. And because we didn't have enhanced 911, they weren't able to locate him, and he didn't know where he was, and he died. He died on the streets of Eugene after he'd been stabbed because nobody could find him. And that's what enhanced 911 will do. There was argument in one of the special sessions I would have been prior to that, because then-Representative Jim Hill, who's no longer in the assembly, when I asked him why we could take this money, he said, well, because they're not ready to use it. And I would submit to you that's inaccurate. And you'll hear testimony today about why it's inaccurate. They are ready to use it. Some counties have used it for other purposes, and there was argument over in the House about that. There was an audit done by the Secretary of State. But my purpose here is to make sure this fund stays a dedicated fund for what it's proposed to do. And it requires a vote of the people to keep our hands off of it. And that's what this is all about.
Thank you.
Very simple little concept. Generates a lot of discussion in this building. And there are folks here who can talk to you about why 911 is so darned important to the state and why we should not take money.
Thank you, Senator.
Any questions? All right, thank you very much.
Enjoy business, labor, and everything else y'all are doing in the next door.
Yes, thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Wild, Mr. Hatch from Lane.
Are we doing 30?
In Washington County.
SGR 30, yeah.
You want to come up too? Yeah, come on up. Let's see now.
Why did we get this?
Just
any order you choose.
Okay. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I think I'll just wait, if you'll just wait for one moment. There's quite a few little handouts distributed.
So, Hasina, can you walk us through just really quickly where the 75 cents go
certainly
currently to answer Senator Hannon's
Mr. Chair, certainly. If you, when you receive the testimony that has this at the top, if you'll turn to the third page, it's just a quick and easy, hopefully, to understand 911 tax fact sheet attached to it, which I believe Mr. Yates received at a prior hearing. A little bit of background about the tax. The tax was instituted in 1981, and it was instituted by this Oregon State Legislature, and it was at that time a 3% surcharge on basic phone telephone bills. In 1991, that tax was increased to a 5% surcharge on telephone bills, and then in 1995, the tax was then changed from a percentage to a flat fee of 75 cents per phone line capable of accessing 911. And that's how that's the background of the tax and how much it is and how it's collected. How the revenues are distributed is listed below that. Approximately 57.5% of those revenues are distributed on a per capita basis to cities and counties to pay for a portion of their 911 costs. And I want to be very clear with the committee that this tax, again, the 75 cents per line, does not fund the entire cost of 911 service at the local level. It funds approximately 20% on average of that cost. 35% of the 75 cents is earmarked for enhanced 911, and that includes both phase one and phase two. And we could talk to you a little bit more. I have some very, very smart people with me on the whole phase two issue. And then there's a maximum of 4% that's allowable to Office of Emergency Management. Currently, they use only 3% of that authority. The rest of that, incidentally, does get distributed back to cities and counties that they don't use. 2.5% or a maximum of $500,000 a year goes into an equipment replacement fund, and then Department of Revenue takes 1% to collect the tax.
So what do the cities and counties do with that portion? Do you know, is it random or is it specific?
No. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it's very specific that they are permitted to use that money only for it's very specific what you can use the tax to pay for also in the statute. Pure 911 costs, operational costs. It's very clear. It's very clearly statutorily outlined what you could use it for. So a city that doesn't, for instance, doesn't operate a 911 call-taking center would then funnel that money to the 911 center that actually does their 911 call-taking for them. So
okay. So it would just immediately bypass.
It's very nice and clean in Washington County. Yeah, and Washington County could probably explain to you how it works in their county because they only have one 911 center in their county.
But all counties, I mean, it's Washington would represent other counties mm-hmm. as we hear from Washington.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yes. So that's the tax fact sheet. Any questions about that?
Not that I have offhand.
Well, it's a pleasure to appear before you today on something positive this session. And something positive for the 911 community. I'm sure, as you know, there are a number of bills floating around that are not so positive for the 911 community. So we're very pleased that Senator Walker has introduced SJR 30. And essentially, as we understand it from her, that the goal is to place in the Constitution some language that would constitutionally dedicate the 911 funds to be spent for those emergency communication purposes that to which they were intended. A little background of what has happened, and I want to really make it very clear to this committee that our intent is definitely not to throw stones or to we're done with the past. We really just want to look forward and be positive on this issue. So the background is merely meant to illustrate what has actually occurred, real case scenario with the 911 tax. In House Bill 3977 from the last legislative session, a bill that also contained the extension of the 911 tax
reauthorization of that tax and a number of other items. Within that piece of legislation was a $1.75 million diversion to Oregon State Police, and I want to be very clear about that, too. So the superintendent, in case he's listening, Oregon State Police did not ask for this money to be diverted to them. It was, as Senator Hanna knows, a way to free up debt, general fund dollars to pay off existing state debt for that equipment. So it was not an OSP grab at the money. It was a decision that this body made to free up some general fund dollars. So that was the first time in ever that since 1981 that the tax has been instituted that money has been diverted for non-pure public or non-pure 911 uses. The second, third, and fourth example of it came during the first, second, and third special session. During the first and second special sessions, $14 million was proposed to be diverted from the 911 tax. $7 million of that would have come from the money being distributed to cities and counties, and $7 million from the enhanced 911 subaccount. Both in the first and second special session, that legislation was vetoed by the governor. During the third legislative session, instead of $14 million proposed to be diverted, $7 million from the enhanced 911 subaccount and $2 million from $7 million. There's actually a total of $9 million. It gets so fuzzy because there were conference committee reports on that one, and we're not successful in getting that vetoed, so I try to block it from my mind. But there was $9 million diverted from the 911 tax, and the governor allowed that legislation to become law without his signature. So we do have precedent for this. We really truly believe that customers who see a line item on their phone bill that says 911 telephone excise tax expect that that money will be used for the purpose by which it was collected for. And so we really encourage this resolution to go forward. In speaking, though, with the whole issue and the chief sponsor of this legislation, I believe that it's truly her intent to get at the 911 tax issue. So perhaps some alternate language could be developed. And what I did was go to Section 10, Chapter 533 of the Oregon laws that contains the 911 tax language. And in that section, it talks about imposing a tax on each retail subscriber who has telecommunication services with access to the 911 emergency reporting system. Perhaps some of that language could be used to substitute out the language that it currently exists in the resolution. What I've also attached to my testimony is an op-ed piece or an editorial from the Oregonian dated July 25th and an article that ran July 22nd with the impending passage of and non-veto of the third special session for funding that was going to be lost for enhanced Phase 2 wireless 911, and then an article that ran shortly thereafter in USA Today on enhanced calls, and then just a listing of vote counts on those issues. With me today is the Assistant Manager for the Washington County 911 Consolidation Communications Agency, and Christy Wild, who is the past president of the APCONINA, who suffered long and hard over those special sessions with me from Central Lane 911. I'm sure that they have additional items to testify on.
Chair Deckert, committee members, I'm Larry Hatch. I'm the Assistant Director from Washington County 911. We support this resolution as well. We look back at what has happened in the past, and I'll be honest with you, we looked at that as sharing the pain that the rest of you were going through, and I would agree with Asena, we're not here to beat anyone up over that. Just that in the future, revenues that are collected under the 911 tax on our citizens' telephone bills be directed to that purpose, and get put to use like in our communications center. Hasina's right. It's 20% of the funding that we have to operate, and that just about covers most of the call-taking function in our 911 center. So it's very important to us and would have to come from our local jurisdictions if we didn't have that. So we're strongly in support of it, and I'd be glad to answer any questions if you had any.
The one question that I had, and it was a graph that we had that kind of, and I've talked to Hasina about this, but at least grabbed my attention, was not being part of at least the in-depth discussion in the prior session, was the growth in cell phones in the early to mid-90s that was somewhat unanticipated, somewhat pretty exponential growth. And that, at least the graph seemed to indicate that, boy, we saw just enormous, unexpected, I don't know if enormous is the right word, a great deal of unexpected growth in the 911 funds, which just leaves them thinking, are there excess? And it seemed to be plateauing now that, you know, the cell phones are not just growing so fast. But it at least led me to at least have the thought in my mind, is there some unexpected excess there? I know you guys don't think so, but maybe why not? Or
Chair Deckard, I would submit that with that growth in the number of phones that were out there, we saw that same amount of growth in the number of calls that we received from those phones. Certainly not every one of them dialed 911, but our call volume increases dramatically along with that for those years, with the number of cell calls that that get generated. In fact, quickly getting up to the 50% level. So that when we look at our call volume as staffing to us, there's a direct correlation there. So with a higher call volume, the more people we have to put in place to answer the calls.
Would you say for a short period there that there were at least some excess dollars that then the 911 community, obviously looking at, gosh, we've got all these more calls, and we have a new technology here. We need to figure out what to do about this. So would you say?
Chair Deckard, members of the committee, I'm Christy Wild, and I'm the manager of Central Line Communications in Eugene, and I'd love to answer that question. One of the things that the FCC mandated that we do with these cell phones that were out there calling us is make sure that they had the same technology that the people using hardwired phones had when they called us. We would know where they were if they couldn't tell us themselves. We do not have that technology in place yet in most of the state, and that is what part of that tax is supposed to pay for. And, in fact, that was one of the problems referred to earlier in Eugene with the man who was stabbed.
Senator,
thank you, Mr. Chairman. As I think most of the folks in the panel know, that in most of Oregon, you dial 911, you don't even get a dial tone. It is because many of the areas simply don't have adequate cell towers and service. And some of the communities that I represent want to be able to use their 911 funds to make sure that there is a net extended, including cell towers, to be able to catch 911 emergency calls. Is anything in this bill preclusive to that effort? It says call centers, so there's a number of there's some verbiage in the testimony, at least, that leads me to believe that the dollars would have to be spent on software, hardware, call center operations, personnel, et cetera, all specifically linked to call centers and 911. But what about extra or additional or extraterritorial expansions of cellular telephone services in order to be able to provide emergency services? Everybody's looking at the back there.
The people in the back are looking back.
Yeah, even them.
Mr. Chair, Senator Farioli, while you were out of the room, we discussed very briefly some potential amendments that might need to be made to the existing language to more clearly capture what exactly it is we're proposing the dollars only be spent for. So there's discussion taking place on that issue.
Mr. Chair, just for the record, I absolutely support the idea of dedicating the funds to 911. That's the purpose. But 911 needs to, in fact, create a system in Oregon eventually where any citizen who picks up a telephone and dials 911 gets not only a dial tone but gets connected to a call center. And I hope that we can extend the concept in a narrow fashion that dedicates the dollars to emergency telecommunications, but broadly enough so that we also can put some sort of interactive services in every corner of Oregon. The example I'll give you is that folks that drift the John Day River recreationally often get hurt, and there is absolutely no way they can get out of that canyon with a cell phone. The addition of a few strategically based cell towers could, in fact, provide 911 network services in those areas.
and the counties that I represent have, in fact, expressed that very clear objective. I wouldn't want to pass out any resolution that would cause a statewide vote that would end up preventing 911 services to be extended in some of those areas where those services are needed.
Mr. Chair, Senator Farrelly, upon further review of the actual language in SJR 30, which we are not proposing be amended, specifically refers to the tax shall be used to fund emergency and public safety communications facilities, equipment, and services.
And Mr. Chairman, if his Senate believes that that includes cellular towers where strategically necessary, then I would agree that does fall under the rubric of equipment.
Mr. Chair, Senator Farrelly, I would defer to the definition as interpreted by the State Office of Emergency Management for clarification.
And the representative is sitting back. Yes, there he is, raising his hand.
Senator Corcoran.
Mr. Chair, I don't like this because we're amending the Constitution to this. It troubles me. But even more importantly, having voted against all the thefts during the special sessions, I'm not sure that this Section 15 really does what you want it to do, because it says if the state imposes a tax on telephone service, we already have a tax on telephone service. It seemed like, and the other thing is the language, this language would preclude us from ever imposing a phone-related tax on anything other than emergency services. So it seems kind of exclusive on that level, too.
Mr. Chair, Senator Corcoran, that's not how I interpret the resolution. I interpret that to read, if the state of Oregon imposes a 911 excise tax, but if it imposes that type of tax.
That's not what it says, though. It says imposes a tax on telephone service.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, Senator Corcoran, again, that's the issue that we were discussing earlier on. Of that, as Senator Hannan aptly pointed out, that covers all of the taxes.
Any taxes. And I will tell you that on Saturday, I used 911 at the top of Willamette Pass, a trailer. And they put me in touch with the state police.
Your skateboard broke down.
My skateboard broke down. I didn't have my helmet. That's right.
Well, now you've piqued everyone's curiosity. You used 911 at the top of Willamette Pass.
Yeah, so I didn't expect that it would work, first of all, that the cell phone would work. No, it did. And I got transferred from one person to another, to the state police, and they weren't aware that this accident had happened, so it was timely. We were about the fifth car that happened onto it, and this damn thing just slid in such a way that it was blocking traffic on both sides, with a cliff on one side and a drop on the other. So I spent an hour up there watching these senior citizens try to dig their, whatever you call those fifth wheel pieces of crap.
Senator Hannan,
it's called a recreational vehicle.
Oh, recreational vehicle.
Yeah.
No, he made critiquing on my clothes earlier. I won't critique him on his phone manners. Who dialed the phone for you?
Anything further?
You don't.
Sorry to entertaining news this afternoon.
You're mean to me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, anything further? Mr. Schneider and whomever else would like to be our last person to testify for the day for Senate Revenue Committee. I'm going to do it here. You've got the honor.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Snyder, representing Association of Oregon Counties, and I'm appearing this afternoon in support of Senate Joint Resolution 30. We also agree that the tax should be used for the purpose for which it was dedicated, and this appears to be an appropriate vehicle and an appropriate approach to get that done.
Appreciate it. Questions? Comments? That was the best testimony I've heard in a long time, Mr. Snyder. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing on SJR 30. We have a busy week this week, work sessions every day, so I thank the committee and Garrett.